investigate all your options. There's a lot of options out there. There's more options than there used to be. It used to be kind of a binary situation, unfortunately. You're going to sell or you're not going to sell. And for the discussion we're having here, there's other alternatives that are often, I think, better alternatives.
You're listening to Driving Performance, your go-to podcast for unmatched expertise in the world of buying and selling an automotive dealership. Each episode features discussions with industry leaders and is brought to you by Performance Brokerage Services, North America's premier family-owned automotive dealership brokerage firm with over 30 years of experience. We're here to ensure you gain the most reliable insights to confidently navigate a transaction and accomplish your unique goals. Whether you're looking to buy or sell, we prioritize building lasting relationships and maximizing the value beyond the transaction level. Here's your host, Jamie Farley, for another segment of Shifting Gears.
Welcome back to Driving Performance. I'm Jamie Farley, and today's episode is one we've been looking forward to for a while. We're joined by someone who's helping reshape how capital meets opportunity in the world of dealership acquisitions and growth. Before we introduce our guest, I'm excited to be joined by my co-host for today's conversation, Jesse Stopnitsky, co-owner of Performance Brokerage Services. Jesse, I'm very excited to be hosting this episode with you today.
Thank you, Jamie. Myself as well, and proud to be co-hosting alongside you. And I am honored to be introducing our next guest. Today, we have the pleasure of being joined by Tim Batchelor, managing partner and co-founder of Open Road Capital, an automotive investment firm that partners with dealers to build and scale some of the strongest dealership platforms in the country. At Performance Brokerage, we've had the opportunity to work closely with Open Road Capital, and I've seen firsthand how intentional their approach is to partnering with dealers. So, Tim, thank you for joining us today.
Great to hear, Jesse, and with you, Jamie, as well. Happy to share my thoughts and learn from you guys.
Well, Tim, it is great to have you on the show. To kick things off, and for those who may not be familiar, how would you describe Open Road Capital?
Well, Open Road partners with dealers, as Jesse said, and dealership families to really achieve what they're looking to achieve. And often that's families that have grown the dealership group and want out. Some members want out, some members want to stay in. And then there's dealers who want to grow faster than their own capital will allow. That's kind of another broad category. And we own currently a majority or minority stake in 48 dealerships with 8 different partners in 6 different states. And we're an operating, I would say, an evergreen operating company, which say we don't ever have to sell our dealerships. We're not a consolidator with general managers reporting to district managers, reporting to regional managers, reporting to me or my partner, Eric. Instead, our partners continue to run their stores as they always have, but with probably more infrastructure and support and capital than they had before. And as one of our partners said once, that I get all the advantage of scale that a public company enjoys, and I receive the support and the help from those outside my stores, that things that otherwise distract my time and take away from building value, but I get to make the day-to-day operating decisions. So kind of best of both worlds. That's what we're out to achieve.
Fantastic, Tim. Can you tell us a bit about your personal background, how you came to co-found Open Road Capital?
Sure. I'll say first, I'm the only member of Open Road who has not spent their life in dealerships, in or around dealerships. We do have 4 CPAs, in-house counsel, and others like that who have worked for service companies, but always in the dealership space. My partner, Eric, he spent his life in dealerships, started off turning wrenches at a Fiat dealership in the 80s. And I can joke, he's probably the only certified master technician to graduate Yale Business School. So he's a unique guy. And conversely, I started my career in the commercial real estate business in Tyson's Corner. We built buildings, we represented large companies. And at some point along the way, I got more interested in the companies that were occupying our buildings than the passive asset that they resided in. So I left and went and ran a manufacturing company, a plastics manufacturing company. And then I went back to business school in New York City. I went into investment banking in New York City. I founded my own investment banking firm. When I moved back, we had a son, didn't really want to raise him in New York City. I think New York City is a great place. I think everybody should live there once and then get back to reality, which is what I did. Came back to Virginia and founded Whitebeak Capital. Then met Eric Chalin, my partner, who, as I mentioned, spent his life in the dealership business. And when he was at Yale, he met people that knew a little bit more about finance, and he learned that there was a lot of capital available, mostly outside of this industry. And he thought that it was applicable to this industry. He told me about the industry. I espoused it, what he was telling me. And I thought, yeah, this is a good industry to bring outside capital in. A lot of people can benefit from that. It's pretty the weight of it. And so we embarked on what eventually became Open Road Capital.
Timmy, what year did you guys found Open Road Capital?
Officially founded with our first investment, which was Toyota Walnut Creek in 2017. But as a lesson in perseverance, I can tell you that we started working together in 2004. And at that time, the manufacturers wanted nothing to do with outside capital. And frankly, the smartest guys in the room, the private equity groups and others like them, misanalyzed the sector. They thought it was a high debt, low margin business. They were commingling floor plan into the capital structure, which turned it upside down. So we had a long, long road to hoe to try to get those two constituents to come together. And it took that period of time before the industry evolved to where we could fulfill our business plan.
Wonderful. So I'd love for you to talk about your model in a little bit greater detail. And how does a partnership work with Open Road exactly? And what makes you unique in the dealership space?
I'll say first, there's really no predetermined structure when we go into discussions with prospective partners. It's really determined by our prospective partners and their families and what they're looking to achieve. I mentioned our constituents basically fit into two broad categories. One is families who may have 25 dealerships. They have all the money in the world, but there's something changing there. The founders, the matriarch, patriarch, they may want to retire. They want to take some money out of the business. They may have a son or daughter running the company and another son or daughter that's not involved in the business. And the people that are running it want to continue. And then there's these people that want money out. And as they said, they may have all the cash flow in the world, but the person that's running has got to pay a multiple of that cash flow to buy out their siblings and their parents. Where's that money coming from? And on top of that, they always want to put their mark on it. Those that are running it always want to grow it. In this industry, you can only grow by buying more dealerships because of territorial restrictions. So where's that money coming from? It's a double whammy. And to date, there's really not been a solution for that. And as a result, very many family-run businesses, in order to rightly satisfy the monetization or equity needs, the wants of family members, end up selling. They've sold to public companies and large consolidators. And that's, I think, kind of unfortunate because they lose the family legacy in the process. And that person that was the heir apparent that was going to keep going, has to go find something to do. So that is one of our constituents. We'll go in and we will buy out those family members that want to get out, and we'll buy any percent. If somebody wants to sell 50% of their shares and somebody else will sell 100%, that's fine with us. And whatever we end up with defines what we own. And it could be a minority or a majority stake. And so that is, and then we'll support that dealer going forward. And I'll tell you more about that later, but we help them grow and put their own mark in business and preserve the family legacy. I'd say an example of that is Heron Gear, where Jack Heron, I asked him what he wanted to do. He was on the fence. Said, I don't want to work 7 days a week. I want to get financial diversification. And I said, well, you've got Reed Hal here. Well, Reed is not a family member, but he's practically a family member. He'd worked for Jack for 26 years. But he's run this group for 16 years, worked for 26 years. Do you trust Reed to run it? He said, yes. I said, well, if you do, we do. Let's elevate Reed to president of the group. You keep your demo and your health insurance and sit on the board and have an influence, and we'll change Reed's life in the process, and you don't have to work 7 days a week. He's all for that. And I said, in terms of diversification, you don't need 100% of your money out to be diversified. Take 60, 70, 80% of your money out, leave 20, 30, 40% in. And by the way, if you roll it over, you can do it on a tax-free basis. And if we can give you a 15% return, hopefully better on a leverage basis, you'd need, what, 23% return if you took all that money out and had to try to reinvest it in something. Where are you going to get 23% return? And to get a higher return on a piece of a business you know better than any you can invest in, and that's diversification. On top of that, none of your employees are going to lose their jobs, which they very well might if you sell a consolidator. The OEMs are going to be happy because the performance isn't going to fall like it often does when consolidators buy groups of stores. And you preserve your family legacy. Name on the door is not going to change. Your heirs can inherit your shares if you pass away, which unfortunately Jack has since passed away. His heirs have maintained his shares, and they can put those shares to us at any time. We'll buy them at fair market value. But for the same reason Jack kept a piece of equity, they have as well. Because that if they sold to us, then they just have to pay taxes on that money, find another place to invest it at probably a lower return. But they have that flexibility, and they're very happy clipping coupons. And so overall, Jack was able to support his protege, in this case, non-family member, but a protege. He was able to get financial diversification and get good return on this invested piece in the auto dealership. He supported his employees. Nobody lost their jobs. The OEMs were happy. And he deserved his family legacy and possibly into perpetuity. So I said, Jack, what's not to like about that? He said, nothing not to like about that. Let's do that. So that's how that deal came along. And that's an example of one of the two broad constituents we serve. And I'll tell you about the second one if you'd like to hear it as well.
Well, I think that's a great example. And it also sounds like you offer a tremendous amount of flexibility, really tailored to what the dealer's needs are and what they're hoping to accomplish.
That was my thought as well, Jamie, was the flexibility is key. Sounds, Tim, like you're starting with the end in mind for the prospective seller and working it backwards to check as many of those boxes and those objectives for them. It's quite a beautiful structure.
They're the ones that decide what they want. Some dealers are more interested in growth than they are in taking capital out. Of course, it could be a combination, but our partner in California, Rinaldi Halim, is a great story. He came here when he was 10 years old from Indonesia, didn't speak any English, and ended up in the car business. He ended up working for Nissan store on 10% of it. His area managers from Chrysler moved over, or from Nissan moved over to Chrysler. They talked him into selling out his stake and investing it all in downtown Los Angeles Chrysler store, which he ended up buying when it was losing $2-3 million a year, turning into making $2-3 million a year. And then he bought another CDJR store that didn't cost much because it wasn't making anything. And then that same seller who had sold him a second store and had arguably better stores, Honda, Subaru, Chevy, decided to fill the other three stores. Didn't even call Rinaldi because he didn't think he had the money, which he didn't. And Rinaldi heard about the deal. He knew about us. He called us and we formed a partnership where he put his two stores in for fair market value. And we put in the cash to buy the other three stores, became a five-store operator. He turned around those second group of stores in about 8 months, doubled the cash flow, doubled his personal cash flow without having invested any capital. And now he's in 10 stores in the area. So his net worth is probably quadrupled in 3 years. His life's changed, I think. And another reason why we exist. So rather than a large family that already built up a group and is looking to take cash out, that was a mid-career dealer who had two stores at the time and he wanted to grow faster than his capital will allow. But I will say that the equation there is very important because, so what's the difference? Why own a smaller piece of five stores, now 10, versus 100% of two stores? Well, everybody that's ever bought stores knows that it didn't take that long to turn them around. If you're a good operator, and that's who we partner with, is good operators. It takes, conventionalism says, 6 to 18 months to turn stores around. Well, after you've done that, you may have a great return on your cash, but at some point you flatten out. You can't double performance every year. And at some point you're bumping along with the state of the economy, call it up or down 2% in either direction, and your net worth isn't changing. And that was the case with Rinaldi. He already optimized these two stores. He could have waited 3, 4, 5 years and saved enough money to buy another store, but he would have foregone the opportunity to buy these other three stores that were sub-optimized. As I mentioned, he, in 8 months after buying them, without putting any of his own money in, he doubled his own cash flow by contributing his equity, and he doubled his net worth. So if you can accelerate the cycle of buying less managed stores as a good operator, you can accelerate your net worth. And that's what Rinaldi did. As I mentioned, he's probably quadrupled his net worth here in 3 years. And let's look at the alternative right now. If he had partnered with us, he would still own 100% of two Chrysler stores, CDJR stores. They're probably worth half what they were when we partnered together. So in some ways, I could say his net worth is probably 8 times what it would have been if he had not partnered with us. And that equation perpetuates. It never ends. Whenever we're buying stuff, we're creating value together. And for that reason, people say, can your partners, and Jesse, you might have asked me this question if I didn't ask it for myself, can your partners buy you out? And the answer is yes. They can always buy us out anytime they want at fair market value, come to agreement. We're happy to take our money off the table. And if that's what supports your goals and dreams, it's fine with us. But I don't know if they're going to happen, because the equation I just cited, where Rinaldi improved his net worth by buying more stores, well, that would be the same equation at any point in time. If he wanted to take whatever money he'd saved along with his debt capacity and buy us out, he'd be buying out the stores we optimized together. His net worth wouldn't be any different a year after he did that transaction than it was the year that we did the transaction. Conversely, if instead he invests that money in more stores that we don't own together that can be optimized, every one of those acquisitions is going to create value. It's going to increase his net worth. And that equation never changes. So yes, if somebody wants to buy us out, they certainly can. Probably won't, because most people are more interested in building value for themselves and their families than they are and be able to say they own 100% of something.
And Tim, how do you determine whether a dealer is the right fit for a partnership beyond the acquisition opportunity itself? What are you really looking for in a partner?
I'd say first, honesty and ethics. Those are the most important things to us. And then number two would be being fair and rational. I was saying the reason why isn't my thing, the reason minds tend to agree, that is somewhat interrelated to being honest and ethical, but not necessarily the same. There's always going to be difficulties that come up in any business, in any industry. And if you're dealing with honest people, rational people, they're generally going to move. And if they're dealing with the same set of information, they're generally going to move in the same direction in terms of decision-making. That underpins our partnerships. That is the profile of all our partners. We've never had a real problem in our partnerships because of number one and two. And then number three would be they've got to be good operators. As I mentioned, the model is pretty simple. We partner with really good operators, and then we buy stores that aren't as well managed as theirs. That's where value comes from. And for that to happen, you know, our partners have to be better operators than the ones we're buying. So that could be better than average. Those are really probably the three main things we're looking for. And we're geographically agnostic. We're currently in 6 states. We'd like to be in 50 states. And every dealership, every brand, and every location has a value. So there's a deal to be had, a reasonable, fair deal to be had in every state and every location with everybody.
Well, and Tim, the fact that you led with values and intangibles before strength as an operator speaks volumes about you and your organization as well. May I ask quickly, you mentioned that you're geographically agnostic. What about real estate? We haven't touched on real estate yet. Does Open Road Capital have a preference?
We have a preference, but not an edict. Our preference is to own the same percentage of the real estate that we own in the operating business. And this gets back to running partnerships, which we learned about. I think we're hopefully pretty good at it. And it is a separate skill set from running dealerships. Running partnerships is different. And if you can keep alignment in your partnership, it makes everything a lot easier. In the case of real estate, if everybody owns their same percentage that they own of the operating business, then it's, and if you decide to increase the rent or reduce the rent or whatever else, it's left pocket, right pocket. It doesn't affect one partner any more than it affects the other. It just makes decision-making easier. It's not an edict, because sometimes we find that foundations or that real estate is owned in family foundations that can cause problems. And there's other reasons why it doesn't always work out. But if it can work out, that's our preference.
Plus, with image compliance and facility requirements and demands for manufacturers, having invested interest alongside your operator with a shared vision and direction makes sense.
Yeah, that's right. Our self-image is we want to have nice facilities. We want our employees to want to come to work. You know, there's an argument, say, imaging facilities, there's no real return on investment. And I think that is true up to a point. But when we bought Soy to Walnut Creek, that operator hadn't put money in facilities since 1969, like Hotel California. And so it was pretty bad. And we're in the process of a major renovation there. I can talk more about that if you'd like, but we have put money into it in the meantime. I think it helps attract and retain employees. It's a good atmosphere. So our image is we'd like to have a nice facility. We'd like to be at or above penetration rates by the manufacturers. We like to have good CSI, all those things. Those all add up to a good ROI as well. And that also helps us with our relationship with our OEM partners, other partners in this partnership. We can't ignore the OEMs. We have been approved by everybody we've been in front of, which is everybody other than like Porsche. And I think the reason we have good relationship, for the reason I just stated, we see it kind of as a three-way partnership.
Tim, are you finding that dealers are proactively exploring capital partners like Open Road and reaching out to you? Or do you find that you're still having to educate dealers on these solutions that are available to them and maybe they don't know about them?
Well, our stretch goal is for every dealer in the country to know us, understand what we're doing, and understand what we can do to help them. But we've got a long way to go. So yes, we're at the stage where a big part of our job is to educate the market. Now, we don't have a lot of competitors at this point. There's a number of family offices that are in, but private equity has had trouble getting in because they expect to have ultimate daily control to hire and fire the CEOs, to decide upon the CapEx and working capital. And they think they're going to teach the OEMs how to write an operating agreement until they get back the ones they've submitted and it's fully redlined. And they realize they don't have any leverage with the OEMs. And they're simply not going to allow them to exercise the typical level of control that they have. That's when they sort of drop out. And OEMs want car guys running it. And that's our model. We have car guys running it. They continue to run it. And a lot of these groups throw in the towel. And as a broker told me, he said, when he receives your calls now, he tells them to call back when they're on their second deal. We benefit from that, frankly. We don't have a lot of people that are up at our model yet. But we still have a lot of educating to do. So I'm more than happy to be on this podcast. The more people that know what we're doing, the better off we are, and hopefully the better off they are too.
And we, Tim, feel that it's just an exceptional tool for dealers who may find themselves at a crossroads. And I'd like to ask you for your advice to our audience here, as dealers are constantly evaluating their growth objectives, their succession plans, or even exit strategies. What advice would you have for those dealers that may find themselves in a crossroads?
Well, you know, that advice I would give would be the same I would give to their attorneys and their accountants and their advisors. That's investigate all your options. There's a lot of options out there. There's more options than there used to be. It used to be kind of a binary situation, unfortunately. You're going to sell or you're not going to sell. And for the discussion we're having here, there's other alternatives that are often, I think, better alternatives for family and for family legacy. And for in that situation, in the situation described, there's going to be winners and losers. If everybody wants out and they want nothing to do with the business, that's great. Sell 100%, everybody's happy. But that's rarely the case. And you know probably better than I do, Jesse, that there's almost always some conflict inside the families, rarely that everybody wants out. And so in a case like that, somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. If they hold on to the dealerships and don't distribute money to people, buy them out, the people that aren't being bought out are unhappy. If they sell, then you've got some people that really wanted to keep it in the family, preserve the family legacy, and continue to run things that aren't happy. But it's not binary. Now, both constituents can get what they want, so they can truly get their cake and eat it too, and have their cake and eat it too, as they say. So I'd say these, and maybe there are other options as well, should be fully explored and fully understood, and then choose from among your options. Like I gotta tell my kids when they were applying for schools, apply to the main schools if you think about getting in, and then create all the options for yourself and choose from among your options.
Evaluate all the options and make the decision that is best for you and your family.
Yeah, and that could involve us. It may not involve us.
But there's a third option now, which for us, of course, 30 years in the buy-sell trenches, it's nice to see another alternative.
I'll say that we are batting 1,000 in one respect, and that is that every conversation we've ever had, the dealers and their families have appreciated it and appreciated learning about it. They didn't feel like they wasted their time, I can tell you that. And that's somewhat of a message to the trusted advisors out there. And I think they, of course, owe it to their client, in my opinion, for their clients to be fully educated. But I think they benefit too, because they're trying to do the best thing they can for their clients. And it also elevates their status and stature with their clients if they are presenting them something they weren't aware of before that's actually viable.
Yeah, it's a value add for themselves and their clients as well. Well said.
Tell us a little more about your acquisition appetite. You mentioned wanting to be in all 50 states, but maybe you can expand on that a little bit further and how you see this growth evolving over the next few years.
Well, I would call that a stretch goal to be in all 50 states. We've got a long, long way to go. I'll also say that we don't have as I mentioned, we're at 48 dealerships. We were somewhat slowed by COVID because we had to make rational decisions at that time. But we don't have a goal in mind to be at 100 by next year or 2 years. And we never had that goal because we didn't want to set artificial goals that could force us or end us to make bad decisions. Instead, we're trying to let as many people know about what we're doing as possible and create opportunities for them and for ourselves. Again, choose from among these opportunities. Sometimes we're going to, and we often do have opportunities where the operators don't hit all three of those objectives I set out or criteria I set out a moment ago, and we won't do those deals. And we purposely not putting ourselves in a position where we have to compromise on those edicts. And we just want to create as many opportunities for ourselves as possible, choose from among them, and see where the chips fall. Whatever it ends up, that's where we end up.
With the types of partnerships and objectives that you're looking to accomplish, your growth should come organically from those principals who are seeking out the collaboration, the diversification, and the services that you all provide.
Definitely. Everything gets easier over time. When we got our first deal, wasn't easy at all. And like I said, it took Eric and I about 13 years to get our first deal done. That was part of that. I was just let the market catch up with the concept. But now more people do know about us. It is getting a little easier from that standpoint. And I think some of the word's gotten out on what we're doing to help our dealers. I think all our dealer partners would say that they are better operators than they were before because we're giving them a lot of services. And there's a lot of stuff like real estate, financial reporting, insurance, these things that don't create value inside the store that we help them with. And it gives them more time to be better operators. And if you don't mind, I'll give you an example on the real estate side. In Walnut Creek, as I mentioned, when we bought that, the operator hadn't put money in for quite a long time. We committed to building the facilities. But by the time we're done with the plans and the setback requirements and all the stuff that California requires, it's going to cost us $60 million to build one whatever dealership. And that doesn't pencil. And so I mentioned I had a real estate background, and I was looking at with Eric, and we're saying, well, we're on Main Street. We're two blocks away from the BART station. It's mass transit. If you know anything about mass transit, you know, densify around mass transit. Let's go to the city and tell them, we've got to leave. We can't afford it here, and you're going to lose all our tax revenue. Or if you let us densify here, which you should, you can quadruple your tax revenue. And it took us a few years to get there, but about 4 months ago, the city rezoned that property, and we're embarking on a $400 million mixed-use facility with Toyota in the middle of it. And we're creating probably $40 million of value for our partners. And we have fantastic partners out there who told us, you know, they wouldn't have thought to do that, and if they had, they wouldn't have had the capital to do it. And so there's an example where we add value to our partners, but it doesn't have anything to do with running the stores. A lot of other things out there that are adding and detracting value from operating stores, and that's where we come in.
And Tim, congratulations on getting that approval and bringing that to fruition. I know that has been a vision for many years, so sincerely, hats off, gentlemen, for pulling it off.
I did. I know the lessons in patience. You know, you got to keep on it.
So Tim, jumping into the buy-sell market for a moment here, from your vantage point, what trends or shifts are you seeing in the buy-sell market that dealers should be mindful of?
Well, one thing that's making life a lot easier in the buy-sell market is the normalization of earnings. That was a difficult period for a lot of people. Unfortunately, a lot of people overpaid. I've heard stories of some dealers who can't even make their interest payments on their loans, let alone fully service their debt. And that is the vagaries of the M&A market. And dealers are not necessarily expert in acquisitions. They're expert in operating it, which does bring to mind a tangential to your question. But part of our model is, if we were buying a store on our own, we can make a mistake. Hopefully we don't, but you know, we're not infallible. We do have a lot of analytics. We do a lot of spreadsheet work. We are doing this across the country. We ought to be pretty good at it. We understand what the legal documents should look like. We understand what valuation is, but it doesn't mean we can't make a mistake. Likewise, our partners or prospective partners, if they're buying stores on their own, they can make a mistake. We've seen it, but because they're not in the business every day, all the time doing it, but they bring to the partnership an operating knowledge, real estate knowledge, local market knowledge, brand specific knowledge. They bring all of that. So then when we partner together and then go buy more stores together, you take the probability of us making a mistake times the probability of our partners making a mistake, and you drive those probabilities exponentially down, which makes the risk return equation much better. That's one of the tenets of our model. And I think that in partnerships like that, we tend not to make really big mistakes. And valuations is one of them. But with things moderating or normalizing, you're seeing less opportunity to make that kind of mistake. There is still this concept of 3-year average times a multiple. Well, that all worked back when 3-year average was in within 2% of each other from 1 year to the next. When you throw even one year in that equation where things have gone up extraordinarily higher than what they had and what they will be, you've now overpaid. And so there is still this opportunity to overpay because there's still a year or so of COVID earnings in those equations. You asked me the question, what's my advice? Don't use that equation. That equation doesn't work.
I was going to say, if still using a 3-year average, of course, and we found over what will be now the last 5 years was the challenge and the crux of valuations was identifying the areas of the business from a departmental breakdown that underwent systemic and sustainable growth versus those that were solely attributed to COVID. Now, you mentioned, Tim, that by the probability of you gentlemen making a mistake multiplied by the probability of your partners making a mistake, therefore, you're reducing the risk, increasing the ROI risk-return ratio. Does that influence the valuations that you're, in fact, putting on the opportunities? Or does it only increase the confidence of attaining those earnings?
It increases the chance that you're valuing the business correctly. I can't tell you whether that's a higher or a lower valuation. Could be either direction, because the obvious is if you miss something, you're overvaluing, that's a problem. So there's opportunity costs for undervaluing things as well. And these partnerships we do help each other out and saying, hey, this is a low hanging fruit here. We can fix that. Now, in this industry, often people are paying for the upside. It doesn't work like that in other industries, by the way. There's a benefit to being a bad operator in this business because you're going to get paid more than you deserve. People are going to value what they can do, and they know there's five other guys that are going to look at it the same way, so they're going to have to pay at least some portion of that upside value. But understanding that upside value is just as valuable as understanding the risks.
Which speaks to the power that the manufacturer, that the franchise command, really. There are pro forma buyers in this industry that you don't typically see in other industries.
Well, again, it's hard. Nobody can really get away with not paying somewhat for the upside opportunities because there's always somebody else that is around the corner that is willing to do so. So competition drives that. Do the sellers deserve it? Yeah. You can argue that. If they ran a tech company, they're not getting paid for what the next tech company can potentially do. Let me revise that. Sometimes that happens. But in most standard businesses, you get paid for your operating income times some multiple. And then the acquirers are improving and benefiting from that. This one, and probably other franchises as well. You can think about McDonald's. There's McDonald's, yeah. Another McDonald's operator hardly needs to know anything about that. All he needs to know is traffic count and demographics, and he knows what he can do with that store. But he also knows there's five other guys that knows what they can do with that store. And so he's not going to get away with buying it for its current earnings, and that works in this industry as well.
Great point. Is there anything that you haven't touched on already that you think would be important to share about what Open Road offers or what you think dealers should understand better?
I think you guys have given me the opportunity to give enough examples, I think, that anybody watching this, a pretty good idea, and hopefully would agree that it's worth understanding fully before people make full decisions of what they want to do. And that's all we're hoping for, is to get in front of and talk to dealers about what they're trying to achieve and let them know what the options are, what the opportunities are. And they'll decide what's right for them. It's not always going to be work with us. But again, as I mentioned, we've never had a conversation that I don't think anybody didn't appreciate.
So, Tim, you touched on OEM approval earlier and how essentially they've blessed Open Road and what you guys do and how you provide a solution. So if a package comes through to them, it's more than likely going to have their blessing if it checks, of course, all of their boxes on their side. How did you approach getting approved as a partner with the OEMs, and what kind of feedback have you received from them when you went through this process?
Well, when we first posed it, it was the Toyota Walnut Creek transaction. It was the first one we got done. And what we were proposing they'd not seen that before. And it took a lot of time to get that understood, work together, to agree on just the way operations are going to work and the operating agreement. And it was a lot of effort and a lot of education in both directions. And that has probably been the case largely with all of the OEMs. However, once everybody has Toyota, it's probably the hardest to get through. Just happened to be the first one we tried. It was the most difficult one. And so once we got their stamp of approval, it certainly put us in a different place with everybody else. But still, everybody has their own objectives and idiosyncrasies and things that they want to achieve. And so every operating agreement is unique between every OEM. But I think the overarching objectives we have and our operating philosophies and all that has rung true with all the OEMs. And for the most part, it's no surprise, the OEMs want to preserve the entrepreneurial spirit. They want to preserve families in the sector. No disrespect to the public companies, but they don't want this to be an industry of public companies. And so we are helping them achieve their objectives. And as we said to every one of the presidents of the OEMs, we know that you've got good operators in your network. We know that your best operators are not always your biggest operators, and you'd like to see those best operators proliferate, but many of them can't afford to buy your dealerships. And we are a bridge to that. We can help you see your best operators proliferate. You can help you shape your network. Because what you want, Mr. OEM, which is high CSI, high penetration, high facilities, all that stuff, that's what we want too. So there's no daylight between your objectives and our objectives, and we can help you achieve yours. And that has basically been embraced by all of them at this point. We have great relationships. And it's one thing to get approved, but we also have received ROFRs and open points from some of the top OEMs, which is a whole other level of approval, or approval by the OEMs in general. Now, Dennis Thornhill, a revered fellow and the head of network for Toyota, he's now joined our board of advisors. Tom Dahl, who is another revered industry executive. He was president of Subaru. Everybody knows and loves Tom, and he's now joined our board of advisors. I think that speaks to the relations we've had with our partners and their support of our model and our shared objectives.
Well, I had the pleasure of working with Dennis for many years when I was at Toyota, so I definitely know how they think in terms of the approval process and what they're looking for. I've got to imagine that a couple of the hot items were making sure that there's someone automotive qualified running the day-to-day. And then what else was it? Was there any other big hurdles, whether it was with Toyota or the OEMs, that you had to make sure they felt really confident about?
That's step number one. They want to make sure that, of course, now they know us and they know our operating philosophy and our objectives. But when they didn't know us, they wanted to make sure that we don't think we're the smartest guys in the room and to come in and tell them how to run dealerships. And so what you just said is exactly, I don't know, it's maybe number ones, two, and three on their list. They also want to deal with fair, reasonable professional people and not have a fight on their hands every time there's something to be discussed. And so I think the same thing we look for in partners, ethical and fair-minded and rational. I think the OEMs like that too. So for those reasons, it's worked out pretty well.
Tim, before Jamie signs us off here, I just want to thank you again for joining us today. I wish you all tremendous success. You are an exemplary company. Look forward to witnessing your continued growth.
Thank you. And we've certainly appreciated the support and relationship we have with Performance. And I'm sure that'll continue forever.
If any dealers would like to learn more about Open Road, where should they go? Where would you direct them to?
You can email me, tbatchelor@overroadcap.com. You can call me at my cell, 202-302-4892. Any of those options.
Tim, thanks so much again. It was a pleasure having you on, and we look forward to talking to you down the line.
Been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Driving Performance. The show notes include links to any resources mentioned in today's show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review. If you're considering buying or selling an automotive dealership, reach out to us at performancebrokerageservices.com or send an email to info@performancebrokerageservices.com.